WHD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire, and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
CBS News Special Report. In the country's second largest city, Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass declares an overnight curfew in the downtown area after several nights of unrest and vandalism during immigration protests. It runs from 8 p.m. to 6 a.m.
Break the curfew and you will be prosecuted.
California Governor Gavin Newsom is scheduled to deliver a major address this hour. CBS's Maurice Dubois in Los Angeles reports.
This is what it's like on the dividing line in downtown L.A. Peaceful protesters here, part of hundreds, a group of hundreds of people in downtown. And right here, we have National Guard troops standing at the ready.
President Trump has defended his move to send in the National Guard and 700 Marines. CBS's Nicole Killian.
They continue to insist that the military is strictly there, mostly in the capacity of trying to secure federal facilities and personnel.
ICE pictures show National Guard troops appearing to protect ICE agents making arrests in L.A. CBS News Special Report. I'm Jennifer Kuiper.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
Brewers try to rebound. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. Baseball tonight at AmFam Field, where the Brewers host the Braves in Game 2 of their series. Quinn Priester on the mound for Milwaukee against the Braves right-hander Grant Holmes. The Brewers losing last night 7-1. The team making some roster moves today, sending reliever Grant Anderson down to Nashville and recalling right-hand pitcher Easton McGee. NFL Packers minicamp underway. I asked GM Brian Gutekunst, why couldn't they hang on to defensive back Jair Alexander when they still have $46 million left under the salary cap?
I think, you know, over the last 4 years, you know, there's been a lot of games missed. And I just think for what that amount of money is, I think that's a lot to pay for a guy who hasn't been able to get out on the field. Like, it's not his fault, just something that kind of transpired. We're looking for something different.
Today, the Packers move Bo Melton from wide receiver to defensive back.
Again, his play on special teams, it's just you don't have too many wideouts in this league that are as effective as he is on teams.
That's Packers head coach Matt LaFleur with Sports on Mike Clemens.
Summer. It's time for Civic Media's Scotty Summer Text to Win contest right here on this local Civic Media radio station. We want to hook you up with $100 cash, Milwaukee Brewers club level tickets, and the chance to win a summer getaway to the Wisconsin Dells area or an escape to Door County. Download the free Civic Media app in the Google Play or App Store. Then listen in for the keywords during the 7 and 11 a.m. hour and 2 and 4 p.m. hour. Text in the keyword and get set to win. It's Civic Media's Scotty Summer. This is 93.5 The Tap.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about, chaos in Los Angeles. And look, understand, this is what Republicans want. This is the fight that they think is going to be the great defining moment for Republicans and Democrats. Tom Cotton, the guy, the senator, who said, we want to double down on this. They see this as an opportunity. He says this gives us an opportunity to remind Americans how extreme the Democratic Party is on immigration. He said Americans have a choice between Republicans, law and order, and Democrats, car-burning, illegal alien rioters. That's how they're framing it. And look, when they have the kind of media structure that they have, when their message dominates, because you have massive control of the media by a handful of moneyed interests, that's going to be your narrative. And you're going to end up seeing lots of things burning, a lot of things broken. And that's what happens in these moments. It's what they were planning on. And it's what they were hoping for. Because, again, this is what they ran on. Anyone who says, oh, I didn't know this was coming. No. We told you this was coming. For anybody who said they didn't think that we'd be using troops, evidently we're mobilizing 500 Marines, going to send them into an American city. You know, just to back up the National Guard, of course. We've militarized the police department. You can't tell the difference between the police and the National Guard half the time. Except that the police are shooting rubber bullets at reporters. They want chaos. Understand, Trump needs the chaos so that we don't realize how horrible of a job he's doing, how bad he is for this economy. Now, he's called the protesters there in Los Angeles insurrectionists, so he knows what the term is. Didn't say that about those criminals that broke into the Capitol on January 6th. No, in fact, pardoned them. But again, that plays into the frame of the Red Hats. He released people who look like them. And as long as he keeps going after people who look like the folks that they're going after in Los Angeles, going to be very popular in middle America. I firmly believe this. The only way it changes is if a wholesome-looking white girl gets killed. Much like Kent State. You know, everyone knows the story of Kent State. There was a song written about it. There was all kinds of stuff. Everyone knew that there were two white girls got killed. A couple days later, you had the shooting at Jackson State. Nobody even knows what happened there. Weren't the right color. Didn't get middle America to go, hey, that could be my daughter. That could be my child. That could be my sister. And sadly, as I've said a number of times, I know I'm going to get a lot of guff for this. But until we see ourselves in this, till we see that potentially it's going to be us, and by us, I mean society, white America, I don't see that there's going to be outrage. This is what the Republicans told you they were going to bring us. They were open, they were honest, and this is what my Red Hat friends voted for. A million people a year, they're going to go and kick down doors, go into businesses, raid homes, break every law possible so that they could attain their number. And I said, look, you know, during the campaign, bad things are going to happen. This is going to cost people their lives. And folks voted for it anyway. Now, the interesting part for me is... we know this is coming. We know that that Trump promised this. We know he likes chaos. We know he wants to use the military. But the interesting part is, Fortune magazine had an interesting story that grabbed my attention. That said, look, you know, the real story of the economy and the inflation and all of this stuff isn't the tariffs. It's going to be the vanishing immigrants who do the labor. And, you know, the article went into saying, look, if you lose a large number of the people who actually do the work, it's going to cause your country to have some problems. And Deutsche Bank and a number of other places have said, yeah, we're making our decisions based on the Federal Reserve hasn't cut interest rates partially because of this. And I guess the thing that we never really talk about in this country is the need for young immigrant labor to come in and do the jobs that, you know, we aren't going to do. And to do it sufficiently cheap that we can benefit from it. But I guess what's going to have to happen, I guess we're going to have to learn the hard way. And I guess we're going to have to learn by it slapping us. Like everything I say, I believe the only way we learn our lesson is when we get slapped across the back of the head with the 2x4 or stomach's empty. The old labor frame, you know, your head gets right when your stomach's empty. Maybe, and I fear this is where we end up. But for now, the chaos, this is planned. This is what they've always wanted. This is Trump's wet dream. We're living it. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1963. That was the day President John F. Kennedy signed the Equal Pay Act. The goal of the act was to end wage discrimination against women. It required equal pay for equal work. One of the leading advocates of the act was Esther Peterson. At the time, Esther was the highest-ranking woman in President Kennedy's administration. She headed the Women's Bureau for the Department of Labor. In 1981, President Ronald Reagan awarded Esther the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the highest civilian honor. She was recognized for a lifetime of tireless work for women, workers, and consumers, including her efforts on behalf of the Equal Pay Act. It certainly was an uphill battle to pass the legislation. Similar proposals had failed to make it through Congress for nearly two decades. Many business interests lined up in opposition. Finally, in 1963, there was enough momentum to pass the landmark legislation. At the signing, President Kennedy reflected on the significance of the measure, saying, "While much remains to be done to achieve full equality of economic opportunity, for the average woman worker earns only 60% of the average wage for men. This legislation is a significant step forward. Our economy today depends upon women in the labor force. One out of every three workers is a woman. Today, there are almost 25 million women employed, and their number is rising faster than the number of men in the labor force. The act had a profoundly positive impact for women workers. Yet today, that impact remains incomplete. Women still only make about 80% of the average wage for men. It is up to today's labor leaders to complete Esther's fight for true pay equality." Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So there are talks, as I understand, Donald got his wish. The Chinese are talking. There's going to be a great deal. My prediction is very simple. There's going to be a great deal. It's going to be the best deal ever. It's going to be fabulous. It's going to be tremendous. It's going to be terrific. Throw all those words in there. It's going to be that word salad of amazing. And it's really not going to help you or me. It's probably going to hurt us more than it's going to help. But hey, there will be some in the donor MAGA world who I'm sure gonna make out pretty well. You know, some in maybe the family. You know, the family. Maybe not Elon, but the family. And here to share some thoughts on the trade talks and what kind of big, beautiful deal we're gonna end up getting screwed with. I've asked Scott Paul to come share some thoughts. Scott's the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, the website. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Good to be with you, Rick.
So what are we making of all of this? I know there are talks, which I think Trump is thrilled about, in fact, was bragging about. Where are we?
Yeah, well, I think that, there's a couple of stages to this. I think this stage is probably Trump wanting to get, rare earth magnets back into the United States because they are needed in things like auto production and defense applications and other things like that. And China had basically blocked them as a retaliatory measure. And I think China wants access to lots of semiconductor chips and not the really high-end ones that do AI, because the U.S. isn't going to give those,
right?
But to other chips that are going to help China. Now, that's a very small part of what the overall problem is, and that's like a prisoner swap, basically, right? It doesn't really address the underlying issues at all. But I think that's about all that they're going to come away from in this round, and then say we're going to continue to talk.
So, if I'm hearing you right, this is victory. I can see Trump declaring victory. There's a press release, pats on the back, a ceremony, but again, not really doing anything.
Yeah, I think that's right. And part of it is like, so I want people to, I do want people to understand that, the United States does have a lot of leverage. Okay, we do, because, the amount of goods that China sends to the United States is very significant and has an impact, a measurable economic impact. What we send to China, not so much, right? I mean, a little bit, hurt around the edges, but not so much. But here's the challenge. And I don't think I necessarily got this right as well. I'm going to just fess up to that, is that China has found substitutes for the U.S. market. I didn't necessarily think that was possible, but the latest trade data shows that the Chinese trade surplus is as big as it ever was. It's just changed. It's not with the United States anymore. That's gone down. But it's not with Europe. And they're squeezing all these goods into the European economy. And Europe is about to get a China shock like we saw. And they're going to see a bunch of factories close and do all that. But the bottom line, what does that mean for the United States? Is that we probably don't necessarily have all the leverage that we thought we had in this, which makes it a very real possibility that we'll end up with some face-saving deal that will help a few sectors of the economy, things China frankly needs, like liquid natural gas, like some agricultural commodities. And it's not going to address some of the underlying issues, and our companies, you know, may not get out of China unless they're kicked out by the Chinese Communist Party. And so I don't know how much it's going to be able to shift the ground here. I still think that we need to de-risk and, you know, in a lot of ways, decouple from China, just because of the labor exploitation, the environmental exploitation, the human rights violations, and the fact that China uses the trade surplus to build up its own military and develop these capabilities that are very scary. So I think it's a good idea, but I think Trump is losing some of his leverage here, Rick.
No, I agree with you. But, you know, when you talk about, you know, a China shock in Europe, I hear maybe an opportunity for the next administration, because clearly it's not going to be Trump, because this is well beyond, I think, their strategic ability. But this tells me that there's an opportunity for the rest of the world to finally coalesce around the idea that, you know, China's the problem. And maybe you're going to have to take them on at some point. But again, I'm a believer in the only time there's ever any action is when there's pain, where there's suffering, where there's misery. That's right. The only thing that, maybe I'm wrong, and I wish I am, but it seems to me that's the only time that we really act.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, Trump didn't try to work with the Europeans the first time around. Biden did try to work with the Europeans on some of these issues with China. And at the time, Rick, they were unwilling to do a lot because they still view the World Trade Organization as like the Bible, you know, and they don't want to deviate from it. Now they're completely going to get swamped by Chinese imports. Trump's certainly not going to bring the European Union together on, you know, to act with the United States. That's just not in his DNA. So I do think that you're right, that part of it gets handed off to whoever comes next. But I think that we might, unfortunately, see another situation here where we've squandered some leverage, where we have not, you know, we're not going to achieve the kind of decoupling that we need to, and that there's a few industries that might benefit, but the rest of us are just going to get screwed by all of this.
Again, because we've put a guy in the White House who had a good hand, but misplayed it the whole way.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's very simple. Like, this is not rocket science, which is, I guess, the very frustrating part. And that is that, you know, if you want to bring manufacturing jobs back, and this is the fundamental challenge here, you know, either you are going to get tariff revenue from tariffs, and I guess that's good in one respect, because you're going to, you know, help, you know, lower the budget deficit or pay for tax cuts for the rich, depending on what your priorities are, or reinvest it into our economy. You're either going to get the tariff revenue or you're going to get the jobs. And as we've discussed, I'd much rather have the jobs.
Yeah.
I'd love to see the jobs, because then I think you get tax revenue if you get the jobs. But I think Trump seems kind of happy getting some of the tariff revenue, making a deal, and, you know, tinkering around the edges with the trade relationship, but not going as far as we need to go.
So if I'm hearing you right, and I think I am, what you're arguing is we need total systematic change of our, maybe another Bretton Woods kind of moment, to where you're re-divvying up the world, and the world's gotta be playing along. 'Cause look, everyone realizes China's the problem here. And I think, I fear, again, the misery angle, that maybe Europe's going to have to learn the lessons that we've learned.
Yeah. Yes. And the modifier here is that it would be like a Bretton Woods with working people having a seat at the table, right? To be able to do this in a way that is just and equitable and advances a lot of other goals as well, because the status quo is not working. The WTO, I think the U.S. has basically given up, rightly so, on utilizing the WTO as a mechanism. Meanwhile, Europe is still like holding to this old time, you know, this old timey religion that they can't let go of until, I think, as you rightly suggest, there's going to be a lot of pain. And then there's going to be even more upheaval in Europe than what we're seeing right now, which is pretty substantial, right? It's pretty substantial political upheaval in Europe, but it's going to get really nasty if there's another wave of deindustrialization in Europe because of the flood of imports hitting them instead of all coming into the United States.
Which is why I still say we should be moving in the direction of still reshoring manufacturing because we need it. I mean, every eighth grader in this country has learned about the arsenal of democracy. First and foremost, for me, that's the part of it. But also, as you point out, you know, I want the jobs because that value-added proposition, you know, makes you a wealthier country. Does all kinds of very positive things, whereas the other, not so much.
Yeah, and I need to do just a 30-second rant here. I promise it will be brief.
Take 60.
So, because I read a piece that Steve Rattner wrote in the New York Times about, like, we don't need manufacturing anyway, basically, was the theme of this. And the problem is, Rick, he has a pedestal on MSNBC and Morning Joe. And so there's all these kind of left of center people who are going to look at that and say, oh, yeah, Steve Rattner's right. And he couldn't be more wrong, right? We do need manufacturing, and it is worth it. And we can find people who will want to work in it if they think there's a future in it. But it's that kind of that's kind of the response that Trump prompts, right? Because if he leans into something, there's some people that are reflexively going to just say, well, that's bad. I know you don't do that because, like, you see, yeah, there is a need to reform trade policy. We need to do it different than Trump wants to do it. But same with manufacturing. Yes, we do need manufacturing. We need way more manufacturing, and Rattner is just wrong about that. But unfortunately, that idea has spread way too far now in the Democratic Party.
Well, it's not just him. I mean, look, that's been the heart of the Democratic, and I think the reason the Democrats have lost a good portion of the working class. You know, I've said I've never been a Bill Clinton fan, and I think he has done more damage to the Democratic Party than anyone can imagine, simply because, as you know, NAFTA was killing off good union manufacturing jobs, his only response is, well, go get an education. And sorry, that doesn't put food on the table.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like the United States has been spectacularly bad at doing that, and it turns out the theory isn't exactly correct either, and that most people who do lose their job to trade end up in a worse job, right, if they get one at all. And so it's worth fighting for those jobs and for having layoff aversion and plant closing aversion strategies so that stuff doesn't happen in the first place. And in fact, it's worth doing that because it takes otherwise. It was interesting. I heard Pete Buttigieg, you know, and he may well run for president, right, talk the other day about his experiences as the mayor of South Bend. He's like, everybody thinks South Bend is about Notre Dame. The truth is it is about autos for most of South Bend's history. And Studebaker closed down, and that was fully two generations ago now. And the town is still reeling from that. And I learned how important that is that Notre Dame will stay there, whatever. But if the industry leaves, it's going to devastate the community. And we've seen that cut and paste all over the country.
No, absolutely, without question. And it's one of those things, you know, as you've said, manufacturing is is worth fighting for. Now, I know I'm going to get a lot of pushback from my Democratic friends over what I've said about Bill Clinton, the Democrats not being very good on this issue. So I do have to add the other side, which is Republicans have been much, much worse. They've been horrible at all of this all along. And I think Trump and the Republicans today are going to make things even worse. So I just want to make sure that's out there. But I think Democrats can do a better job. I think they have to atone for what they've done in the past, fess up and own up, and then move forward in a way that says, look, we've got to take on China. Look, we've been talking about China being a currency manipulator for at least a decade.
Decades.
And here again, we still haven't. Have we ever labeled them a currency manipulator?
We've done it exactly like twice, basically, in 25 years, when they've manipulated it virtually every year. So, and Trump did it once because he was aggravated at them for something else, and he was just trying to make a point, you know, kind of because it was a petty
because of course
naming, you're right, and they got named one other time, and that was it. So yeah,
and not this time.
No, not this time either. Even though it's very clear that the yuan is undervalued, that's how they get this massive, they're going to have a $1 trillion trade surplus in manufacturing this year. $1 trillion surplus in manufacturing. So yeah, they have a currency that works for that and ends up hurting not only us, but other manufacturers around the world as well.
So let me ask you a last line of questioning, because, you know, again, we were talking about reshoring manufacturing. We want companies to come back. We want new innovative industries to stay. The things that we develop, we want them to stay and not race off to somewhere else, because I think we all agree that innovation, you know, comes out of the manufacturing process. And, you know, that tinkering that past generations have done, we're losing. I guess the question is, with all of this instability, with all of the talk of tariffs, you know, widely all over the place, who knows what Trump's mood going to be in? Maybe he's going to label us a currency manipulator because he's mad at somebody here. How is this good for reshoring manufacturing? How is this good for having any type of industrial policy?
Yeah, so the credit that Trump deserves is for at least understanding that manufacturing is important, right? But that's not a revelation. Like, Biden thought it was important. Obama said he thought it was important. So this is not something new, but it's how you go about it. And part of it is, yes, having tariffs. I think that's a part of it, but they have to be the right size and they have to be done in a way where you know they're not going to be changed in a couple of weeks. Rick, he's already changed the tariff policy something like 54 times in the first 130 or 140 days. And so if you're changing the tariff policy basically once every 3 or 4 days, that doesn't give any business, particularly a capital intensive business, the certainty they need to make that kind of investment in the United States. And then there's something that I heard. I went back to Indiana, which is my home state, over the weekend, and I also heard something interesting, you know, from a lot of Republicans, and this was surprising to me. And they're like, how does Trump think he's going to do this if he's scaring all the labor away, basically? Because the unemployment rate in manufacturing is very low. In fact, most people can't find manufacturing workers. You know, how are you going to do it if you're driving away a lot of potential workers? And look, I get a concern about immigration if the unemployment rate is 10% or something like that, but it's not. And in manufacturing, it's not. And so it was interesting to me. So part of it is having the right policies. Part of it is having stability. And then you see what he does to a guy like Elon Musk, who has a major manufacturing footprint in the United States. And it's like, you get crossways with Trump, you know, he wants to try to screw you in every possible way. And so who's going to make an investment if they know that there's this, like, you know, this kind of like petty kleptocracy that is very unpredictable at stake? That is not like how any sort of a capitalist system should work, you know, much less one that puts workers at the center and involves them in some of the decision making as well, Rick.
Yeah, and you also got to worry that, hey, maybe they're going to send ICE or the U.S. military to come kick in your door and inspect your workforce.
Yeah, it's happened. right? You know, it's happened. So yeah, this is a real problem. And again, to Democrats, and I agree with you that Republicans have been part of the problem too, you know, in the past, but Democrats, the solution is not to say manufacturing is important. Say, here's what we need to do, right? This is where we can work with Trump on some of the trade stuff. We can perfect it, but we need a workforce. We need investment for training. We should not get rid of like the semiconductor investments, the infrastructure investments, the clean energy manufacturing investments. Those are part of our future. There's plants that are being built all over our country. You want them to continue to be built and to have workers in them. And some of them are good union jobs as well. So I think that's what the rallying cry has to be.
I'm right there with you. Scott, as always, good stuff. I appreciate the time. Look forward to talking to you again very soon.
You bet, Rick. Thanks so much for having me on.
I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Do you think if you were running a business, would you come here given the climate of this administration? I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back.
.5 The Tap. Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Partly cloudy and milder tonight with a low in the upper 50s. For Wednesday, increasing clouds, chance of showers in the afternoon and evening. High upper 70s to 80. Shower chances continue on Thursday. With more clouds, cooler highs, mid-70s. It's 71 right now.
Timeout.
All right. Remember, we're a team that plays together. Listen, the winning will take care of itself. We just have to get everyone involved.
In interscholastic sports, we celebrate what makes every one of us unique. And in the pursuit of a common goal, everyone in the huddle, in the bleachers, and in the community comes together. This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So one of the things I've been saying for the last, you know, 20 years or so is that regardless of political ideology, of voting patterns, I think the majority of people in this country agree on a number of things, and most of them are economic. This is where I agree with James Carville. It's the economy, stupid. But most, I think, and this is where my mind has always been, most working people agree that a progressive economic agenda, one with higher minimum wages, one with stronger unions, one where we tax people like Elon Musk and their ilk, where we expand our social safety net, those are things that are widely popular. And I think if you ran on that agenda, you might have something. So when I saw my next guest's most recent piece on the working class and college educated voters wanting this new progressive agenda, well, we got to get it on the program. That's why I've asked David Madeline to come share some thoughts. He's a senior fellow and senior advisor to the American Worker Project there at the Center for American Progress. David, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick. Thanks for having me.
So, you know, I've been saying this for years that, you know, if you get into the middle of the road there, most people want, you know, good wages, you know, health care, retirement security, all of those things. That's the populist agenda that I think we could get behind. And look, both the working class and college educated voters support things like raising the minimum wage. You know, why do you think that policy in particular, why do you think that has such widespread support?
Yeah, Rick, I think there's a lot going on here. So, you know, typically, at least over the past several elections, they've seems like college educated and non-college, the working class, have split in how they vote. And that's even been so-called the fault line in American politics is about education. And yet we've got this report highlighting, and especially you focus on the minimum wage, there's a lot that working class and college educated agree on. And the minimum wage is one. And to me, what's key about it is it's part of making work pay. That's among the reasons I think you see such great popularity for raising it. You know, the poll question is about $17 an hour. Like that's significant. The federal minimum wage is $7.25, so this will be a big increase. And you get high support, and we're talking about 60% support, even from college-educated who are slightly less supportive than non-college on this question. So really widespread support for the minimum wage, and as you alluded to, a whole bunch of other things, especially stronger unions and making the rich pay more in taxes. So there is an agenda here that could draw really broad support if any party really focused on that.
Yeah, see, I'm old enough to remember a time when, you know, your college educated upper management, you know, management types were pulling for those high school educated union members to get raises so that, you know, and it was radical self-interest. Don't get me wrong. And I remember people going, you know, management going, hey, go get as much as you can get because, you know, we're going to get a raise as well. So it was that rising tide lifting all boats thing.
Yeah, I think because that hits at sort of some of the underlying trends that are happening in our economy. So we know for those without a college degree, wages have barely grown over decades, barely grown. For those with a college degree, they've done a little bit better. They have had growth a little bit above inflation, and they've done better than the non-college folks, but not anywhere near as well as either college or non-college did in the 50s, 60s, 70s. Instead, the vast majority of the gains over recent decades have gone to the top 1%, the 0.001%, the Elon Musks of the world have done incredibly well. So most of us are angry and say we could do a whole lot better. And if politicians wanted to focus on that, our core economic needs, you know, things are very expensive. Housing, healthcare, it's scary. We all feel vulnerable that the economic situation could change real fast and even the little bit we have could be taken away. So, yeah, I mean, that's what I want politicians to focus on and among the reasons we hit this report. And as I keep saying this is 60% levels or above support for these kinds of policies, which you don't find around much else.
Yeah, and especially at this time in our political history. But what role do you think unions have in all of this? I mean, you're talking about what 6.5% of the private sector workforce, completely under assault in the public sector. Given that their numbers aren't as big as they had once been, but approval. You know, people understanding that they're important. In fact, both groups, both high school educated and college educated. Believe that the decline of the labor movement has been negative for them and for working people. What do you make of that? What do you make of unions' roles in this?
Well, I make that the American public is pretty smart on this. They certainly know what's happened, that unions help build the American class into the envy of the world, that when workers have power to come together and bargain collectively, they raise their wages, but they also raise wages for others who are non-union, like the management you were just talking about, that also are going to see it. A similar raise. And as unions have weakened, inequality has risen, wages have stagnated. And you see this in the US, but also around the world. It's really one of the most sort of true statements you can find is that unions are the key reason the economy doesn't work for most, the decline of unions is the key reason unions, that the decline of unions is a key reason that the economy doesn't work very well for most people. And strengthening unions is something the vast majority of the public wants because they see it as the way to make a fairer, better economy with higher wages, better healthcare, better retirement, and a stronger voice in democracy. When workers are come together, that politicians actually are more likely to listen to them and do what they want. And we need all of that.
And as a vehicle to help deal with the massive wealth inequality and economic inequality that we see in the country. And look, you know, it's interesting from your poll that the majority of both college-educated and non-college-educated voters support taxing people over $400,000. So what does that suggest about the attitudes we have in the general public about wealth inequality in this country?
Well, people are angry and they're frustrated. That people want big, big changes right now. They're not satisfied with mere tweaks or just defending the status quo. And I think that's part of why we have Donald Trump in the White House right now, is that, you know, President Biden was seen as and his party was seen as defending the status quo. Oh, the economy is doing great, and I've made these improvements. And in my mind, he had done several things that were going to help workers down the line, but they weren't enough at the time. And when he was just saying, hey, this is good, things are good, and people are like, what? Inflation is really high. The cost of eggs are really high. The cost of my housing, I can't even afford a dream beyond anything I could conceive to buy a house. That led to this, you know, people are frustrated and they want change. They don't want the change that Donald Trump's delivered in for the most part either. They're frustrated with him, but they wanted change. They don't like, you know, the tax cuts for the rich, which is the big policy he's pushing right now to make taxes much lower on the Elon Musk's of the world instead, and cost us with things like make it harder to get Medicaid to cover our health care when we are struggling. So it's the exact wrong direction. But unfortunately, but the thing is, people want change because the status quo is not working, and they were hoping Trump would give it to them, and he's given them the opposite of what they say they want.
Right, but we've been sold on this idea, David, that if we raise taxes on the rich people, you know, everything's going to dry up. They're going to take their money and run, and it's going to hurt investment. It's going to hurt the economy. We're going to lose jobs. It's going to be all this hat trick of horrible if we just have the audacity to do what many other countries have done and tax their billionaires. What do you say to that?
Well, and it's what we used to do in the United States when the American middle class was the strongest in the world and the envy of the world. The tax rates on the top were much higher in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. Even 90s were much higher. We've gone downhill there, and our economy at the same time was doing very well because the rich, when you give them more money, they're not really just investing in things that build businesses. They're much of it. They're keeping it for themselves and their heirs and all that. And instead, when the middle class have more money, and when government actually is able to fund decent investments in education, in infrastructure, and the like, the whole economy, it works better with a virtuous circle where you have, you know, consumers have, there's growing consumer demand because the middle class is stronger. So it's the whole theory of how the economy works, this trickle-down idea, you cut tax for the rich, is based on bad and wrong economics. Instead, you got to make the economy work for the middle class. And that means, you know, taxing the rich more and the middle class less.
Yeah, I mean, we've been told that they're smart. The rich people are smart. They're rich. So they must be smart. They know what to do with the money. And look, I agree with that sentiment. They do know what to do with the money. They make themselves richer. It's not good for you, for me, for society as a whole, but they know how to make themselves richer. Now, you brought up infrastructure there a second ago, and interestingly enough, what, over 80% support the infrastructure bill that Biden passed, that $1.2 trillion bill? So the question I have for you is, one, why can't we get a bigger, more... This is one of the things I agreed with Trump's first term. He was talking about $3 trillion back then. He got nothing. But, you know, for me, this is a big deal. Public investment in our infrastructure, in our roads, in our bridges, and our education and healthcare and all that stuff, extremely important. And I guess the other part of the question is you know, what specifically do you think, you know, investments, what we should be going after, what gets the best bang for the buck?
Well, there's a lot there, and I'll try to take it on. The polling we highlight in the report shows that the middle class, that the working class and college educated strongly support greater investments in infrastructure, roads, bridges, et cetera. And the question was roughly along the lines of what President Biden did, over 80% support from college and non-college for that. That's clear that we see the roads we drive on. We know how bad they are and how much investment they need. We know that when we're stuck in traffic, that's a waste of our time, but also the cost of getting goods to and from markets. We know we could have it much better. We also know more modern infrastructure, the beyond just the basics that we've had for now, but the infrastructure of the future, the broadband wireless, the industries that we expect, the silicon, the chips that we expect. So that's where I would invest, things that are public goods that are going to benefit everyone, but really are where the most modern economies need, is sort of the cutting edge, and that private investment won't do good enough job on its own. So when you have all those things coming together, that's where the public should invest. And it's clear that that's what most Americans want to happen.
Now, I mean,
unfortunately, we're seeing public investment withering right now. You know, Biden made a small step towards what we need, but under Donald Trump and DOGE, we're actually cutting the kinds of things that, that would provide, in my opinion, lasting economic benefits for the public.
No, it's one of those things that, you know, right when Trump took office the first time around, they were floating this idea, and I'm sure you may remember, of like a $3 trillion investment package. Now, I didn't agree with how they were trying to gimmick that to happen, but the fact that we needed $3 trillion back then in 2017 was accurate, was spot on. The American Society of Civil Engineers actually said we needed about $3.6 trillion. We're up to about almost $5 trillion in need now. So the longer we wait, the more expensive it gets. But again, as you've pointed out, we the populace, we want these investments. And, you know, personally, I think about, not a huge Thomas Friedman fan, but I liked his analogy of saying, look, you know, we used to be a country that pushed the technological edge. We did things that moved us in the right direction. And he said that, you know, he had gone from Beijing to LAX, and it was like going from the Jetsons to the Flintstones. That's how far we've fallen behind. So for me, there's a great opportunity of a message to go, yeah, we could be that Jetsons if we so chose.
We were certainly the closer to the Jetsons, America. We were at the cutting edge. We still are in a lot of respects, but we have, in order to maintain that, that is not something that just inevitably is going to happen. It takes public investment as part of it, and you know that's the real question to me. Among the real questions is whether we're going to maintain that edge we have, and are we going to do it in a way that benefits all Americans? Because being at the cutting edge, I can understand some frustration. Being at the cutting edge of technology for the past 20 or 30 years has not done enough for most Americans, because the gains, again, have gone just to the top. So when we make the investments in infrastructure, we also need to make the investments in unions, a higher minimum wage, et cetera. And so that's partly why we put out the report, highlighting not only the college and non-college support very similar things, but there's, I think, a pretty clear package of policies that we think hang together. There's, you know, things making work pay, the minimum wage, unions. There's also taxing the rich more to pay for goods that everyone else depends upon, the infrastructure, but also improvements in Medicaid, so we have health care and can depend on it and aren't, you know, subject to the whims of the worst system, where if you lose your job, you might lose all your health insurance.
Yeah, and you bring up health insurance. That's, again, another one of those things that you guys looked at in your polling. And look, expanding Medicaid, it had strong support. Everybody I talked to can't believe the administration is going in this direction. You know, what did you come up with? You know, because, again, this is, for me, I believe everybody wants virtually the same kind of stuff. Healthcare, a strong safety net. That stuff seems to be popular across college educated, non-college educated. What did you find on those fronts?
I mean, why aren't we getting what we want? We didn't look into why our democracy is not delivering what most Americans want. You know, I've got our hunches, and we've talked a little bit about this, but the political coalitions that run both parties don't really care as much as they could or should about ordinary the economics of most Americans. And so we need, in my mind, to have our figure out changes that are going to make our democracy more responsive to actually what citizens want. And we've harped on a lot of kind of changes that, you know, go into there, but this is where you and I agree. Part of the key changes here are unions, because when more workers are in unions, they are stronger voice politically. Politicians are much more likely to listen to them. And one of the good things that's happening today is that both parties are starting to compete for unionized workers. For a long time, Democrats sort of owned the union vote. And a handful of Republicans, in my mind, nowhere near enough, but a handful of Republicans have started to say, we are going to try to win unionized voters with even sometimes doing the right kind of policy. And so if we had all politicians actually wanting to win workers and unionized workers, that would be a big step towards making our democracy function better.
No, I agree with you. You know, I go back to the Eisenhower quote, you know, that anybody who comes out against, you know, labor unions, unemployment, Social Security, they wouldn't be heard from in our political history. He goes on to say there are a few Texas oil millionaires and rich people and a few politicians, but their numbers back then were negligible and they are stupid. was his line. Sadly, stupid seems to be running one entire party and a good portion of the other. So I'm hoping someone takes this information. Some political leaders out there go, hey, I read David Madeline's report. Maybe this could be a way towards electoral victory, you think?
Well, so I just had an event where I had a discussion with Representative Greg Kassar, who is the chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, basically the left wing of the Democratic Party in the House, and Representative Nikki Budinski, who is a vice chair for the New Democrats, basically the more centrist Democratic wing in the House. And I had an event discussing this report and sort of how to win working class voters. And both of them focused on the need to improve economic policy. And both of them talked about minimum wage and especially unions and higher taxes. So they're both, these are young leaders. They were elected in 2023 to the House. So I see some potential, and they represent large constituencies. They're especially, Budinski represents a working class district, but they also represent the biggest constituency groups within the House Democratic Caucus, over 100 members of Congress in both of their groups. So yes, I see some potential to really focus on this set of issues. We're not there yet by any stretch of the imagination, but I have some optimism.
I hope you're right. I hope there are some Republicans who are moving their party in the direction of supporting labor. I see it right now as just rhetorical. I don't see any action, any true action, but we'll see. And I hope it's a wake-up call for Democrats to get their heads out of their behind and start returning to their roots. But I hope folks will check out the piece, Working Class and College Educated Voters Want New Progressive Economic Policies, written by David Madeline and the team over at the American Worker Project. David, thanks for taking time for us.
Of course, Rick. Thanks for having me.
Great stuff. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. You think this is the way forward? I mean, after all, this is what we've been saying for about 20 years now. So maybe they'll wake up to it. We'll see. Want to hear your thoughts? rick@thericksmithshow.com. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1946. That was the day that the U.S. Supreme Court handed down a decision that would have massive implications for American workers. The case was known as Anderson v. Mount Clemens Pottery. The pottery company was operated on a large 8-acre property in Mount Clemens, Michigan. Each day, the workers punched into their shifts and then had to make their way to their workstations. There, they had to get ready to work, perhaps donning gloves, sharpening tools, or readying their workstations. The company estimated that these tasks took 14 minutes. So, they subtracted 14 minutes from the workers' timesheets each day. Seven workers had enough and decided to sue the company, with backing from their union. They argued that they should be compensated for their entire time, including the time it took to prepare for work. The Supreme Court agreed with the workers. Justice Frank Murphy wrote the decision for the court. He himself was from Michigan and had previously been the mayor of Detroit and the governor of the state. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court case was not the last word on the matter. In 1994, the State Bar of Michigan and the Macomb County Bar Association helped erect a historic marker commemorating this important case. It described what happened after Justice Murphy's determination. Quote, the following year, Congress, responding to the Mount Clemens Pottery decision, enacted the Portal to Portal Act to relieve employers of the obligation to pay for time spent in non-productive activities, except where such activities are compensable through custom or contract, notably through collective bargaining. In other words, Congress passed a law undermining the court's protection of workers.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So again, this is what we've been talking about for a very long time. You know, we've been fed all of this division. We've been fed divide and conquer. And the reality is, you know, I do agree with the frame that we're not all that much different. It's just we've put ourselves into camps. And look, I'm in a camp as well. I believe in life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. I believe that in this country, you should be able to do whatever you want. As long as your rights don't infringe on mine, we're good. And I think we can do that. We used to. Somehow it's you know, the 24-hour right-wing rage machine giving us our 2 minutes hate 24 hours a day. That's got us off what really is important. And I point to the quote that's often attributed to Jay Gould, the railroad magnate from the 1880s and 1890s. I can easily pay half the working class to murder the other half. We're witnessing that. And, you know, during the break, you know, I mentioned to David, I go, you know, when, you know, because I was curious if he had the number. I said, you know, what was union density back when yellow dog contracts were allowed? And he goes, well, higher than it is now. So when it was basically illegal, when an employer could fire you for signing a union card, for saying that you wanted to identify as a union member, you could be fired for that, legally fired for that. Union density was higher than it is now. And why is that? Especially when you consider the fact that union approval ratings are through the roof. 70-some percent of people approve of unions. A huge number of people want to join unions. Even people who aren't going to be in unions understand the benefits. So why isn't union density higher? And the truth of the matter is, over the 90 years that the National Labor Relations Act has been in place, it's been eroded away to the point to where the law's not on your side. The original intent was to get people to join and form unions, to join, to collectively bargain for better wages, hours, conditions, to share in the wealth. That idea of working hard, playing by the rules, and you get ahead is actually something, regardless of your educational attainment level, something that we kind of believe in. And it shows in their poll. Now, for me, we talked about this yesterday on the program about, you know, what agenda we should be following. I've said, you know, many times, strong union rates. Yeah, that's great. We need that. We need a higher minimum wage. We need stronger social safety net, better Medicaid, better Medicare. You know, maybe a national health program. Maybe a way to ensure that safety net is there in emergency times. But for me, the big one is always you need to undo, you know, the 40 plus years of Reaganomics. You need to go back and have a very high top marginal tax rate, because you cannot have in a democratic society where we've now ruled, thanks to Citizens United, that money is speech. You can't have a system where one guy has so much more speech. And Elon Musk, to me, is that poster child. When you can spend $280 million and the threat of throwing $1 million or $1 billion or whatever at a congressional race or a Senate race or whatever, kind of a big deal. And the fact that you have one person with that kind of outweighed wealth is not good for democracy. And I think, look, across educational attainment levels, everyone, I think, agrees. It's just a matter of now, if you had politicians who, I don't know, number of Democrats who might get their heads out of their behinds, might actually stand up for the working class, might not be a bad idea. Might not be a bad idea to have working class-centric policies, considering we're still the majority. You still need people to show up and go to work and do those jobs and make sure that the economy runs. Seems sane, rational. Seems easy. But in a time where we're chasing the almighty campaign dollar, that's what's gotten hard. So for me, again, Citizens United, a huge, huge obstacle in getting where we need to go. But ultimately, it's us. It's you. It's me. It's us demanding better. And I hope folks will check out David Madeline's piece over there at AmericanProgress.org. Because, look, I think this is the way forward. I've been saying this for a while. You know, pretty much every year that I've been doing this show, this is the pathway to working class solidarity, to uniting this country and returning a working class to a prosperous working class. And maybe we tap down some of the anger. Maybe we find each other again. Maybe Thanksgiving won't be as ugly in the future. if we take off the red and blue hats, put on a union hat. As always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At rick@therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap, WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire, and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. Amid ICE raids and detentions that have sparked protests, California Governor Gavin Newsom says if some people can be snatched off the streets without a warrant based on only on suspicion or skin color, then none of us is safe.
Authoritarian regimes begin by targeting people who are least able to defend themselves, but they do not stop there.
He has tried to, in court, stop President Trump's order sending National Guard troops and Marines. Meantime, Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass has announced a curfew from 8 p.m. to 6 a.m. It's in a one-square-mile section of the downtown Los Angeles area.
Some of the imagery of the protests and the violence gives the appearance as though this is a citywide crisis, and it is not.
During a visit to Fort Bragg to celebrate the Army's 250th birthday, President Trump has told soldiers,
"What you're witnessing in California is a full-blown assault on peace, on public order, and on national sovereignty."